I'm going to call the meeting to order. Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Item 3, roll call.
John Steinbrück.
Here.
Chris Keckler.
Here.
Mike Polakoff.
Here.
Dave Klimisch.
Here.
Mike Serpy.
Here.
Item 4, citizens' comments.
Mr. President, there were no sign-ups this evening.
Anyone wishing to speak under citizens' comments? Hearing none, I'll close citizens' comments. Move on to item 5, administrative report.
Village President, Village Board, as presented about a month ago, the Village contracted with Dooley & Associates to address several branding needs for the Village. These included a Village word mark, the reevaluation of the Recplex apparel logo, and then also the Pleasant Prairie Convention and Visitors Bureau logo. At this time, the Pleasant Prairie Convention and Visitors Bureau logo is still in production. However, I did want to bring to you the Recplex logo and also a word mark for Pleasant Prairie just to present. Just to review with the Recplex logo, I can ask Craig to come up just for fun. The main concerns that we were dealing with the Recplex logo at the time was the multiple colors. If you'll recall, probably about a year ago, made a modification to the Recplex logo, used the triathlon swooshes, and then had a different RP. The multiple colors of that logo made it difficult to apply to apparel. Also, the incorporation of the triathlon graphic was a limited message in the sense that it wasn't representative of all the Recplex activities. And then also, there was some concern about the relevance was dependent upon the triathlon continuing to be here in Pleasant Prairie. And then also just that the graphic itself was complex and kind of defeated the original intent to have kind of a simple look. And so with staff, we spent quite a bit of time. And I guess, Craig, I'll let you introduce this concept and kind of the thoughts and feels for the new apparel logo.
So for the P and the R, it's kind of a hidden message. And with Under Armour, they've got the U and the A, and the U and the A are the actual mouthpieces. Most people don't know that, but it's the mouthpieces upside down. For us, what we tried to go with was the P representing kind of the oval of the track, the inside of the P being what the hockey rink would be, and then the R with the leg of the R, kind of what the lap lanes would be in a pool. So it was to incorporate the whole recreation complex. It's very clean. It looks good on apparel with the Recplex and Pleasant Prairie. Ours was very long, if you will, high. This is a nice standalone where it's clean up top with just the logo, and then with the whole thing down below, it's just going to look a lot better for because we're going to use that one logo for our play-by-play, and then, of course, for our apparel, the different things that we can do with hats and the shirts and stuff.
One thing just to add is that we do still intend to use the Village logo as the a brand for the Recplex facility and also for even in the play-by-play, you'll still see the Village stamp, if you will. One other item, this is still kind of a discussion point, but just to give you some, allow you to understand the flexibility or the versatility of this logo, is there is also the ability for us to modify the colors. So we're using the blue as kind of the dominant color, but we haven't quite talked about this, at least for the different departments or the different areas within the Recplex, but a possibility would be to make modifications where that could be a red or a green, green for the field house, red for personal fitness or any other combination. So We're really excited about this, and I guess we've prepared this final proof and wanted to present it to the Village Board. And if there are any questions, otherwise we can let Craig sit down. So then the last bit is the word mark. Basically, when I first arrived, Mary Jo, our communications manager at the time, had expressed some concerns with the brand of the village being able to be applied at a horizontal level. Our current logo is very vertically aligned, so it's horizontally challenged, if you will. And so with that, a word mark basically serves as a stamp and is a tool that rounds out the brand of the village. It can also be applied to apparel or to photos, videos, other materials. And so this is basically the concept that was brought forward by Dooley. I think that it's smart and utilizes the main theme of the current village logo. Our intent is to still use the vertical logo in all of our formal forms and pieces, our signage, et cetera. But if we ever come to a point where we're vertically or horizontally challenged, I guess, we might use the backup logo. The word mark would be more for pieces like if it were to be on apparel or let's say, for instance, you wanted to create a pen that could be used for a Pleasant Prairie pen. That's the concept, at least. So unless there are any questions or comments. Tourism is still in the process of making their logo. They're working very diligently on that, and that's a discussion for another day. But we're pleased with what we've created or what we've kind of rounded out the tools, the assets that we have, and what Dooley's provided us.
So with these logos, it'd be the horizontal logo would be obviously the color unless it's black and white, and the word marks, it would be one of those three?
Yeah, so for instance, if it's white, most likely we would use the color for the word mark. If it's a white, you could use black if you wanted to, depending on the situation, if it's like a black and white piece. The blue, all that's to represent is like, let's say, for instance, you were to put it against a photo and there were a dark background, you could use that white stamp. And so it's just to show you that you can use either the black or the white to provide the stamp. Most of the time, though, we would use the color. That's all I have.
Definitely going to work on Band-Aids and bumper stickers.
You got your share of those.
That's it, Nathan?
That's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Nathan. That moves us on to item 6, new business. Our first item is item A. Consider resolution 1844 and authorizing the issuance and sale of $1,380,000 general obligation promissory notes series 2018. Kathy?
Yes, Mr. President and Village Board, this is our first and only issue for this year. So we're actually issuing debt for general government. What we're issuing for is to finish our dark fiber ring from the Village Hall along 165 out toward Recplex. And then an ambulance, we're contributing $253,000 to an ambulance that we purchased. The ambulance is over $300,000, but we're only doing $253,000 of borrowing. And then a fire truck. Both the dark fiber and the ambulance we've already paid for, and the fire truck will be delivered and paid for in 2019. So the total borrowing project cost is $1,352,000, and we went out for sale today. We're looking at issuing a four-year note with a little bit higher principal interest in the first 2 years and a little bit lower in the third and fourth year. Our effective interest rate we got was 2.43%. The spine was rated by Standard & Poor's, and we maintained our AA rating. And we have Gene Schultz in the audience, which is our underwriter, representing Piper Jaffray. Our financial advisor, Jim Town, couldn't be here tonight. So this is, I'm looking for a roll call vote to approve this issue of this bond.
You said the principal's paid back at a higher rate in the first couple of years, meaning there's less interest paid overall?
Yes, we're looking at a four-year note. Usually we go 10 years out, but we structured this one a little bit shorter with more principal due in the first 2 years, which is 19 and 20. We're not, our budget for 19 doesn't have any borrowing in it, so we're able to keep our debt level by the having the same amount for 19 and 20. And then to give us some leeway in 21 and 22, we brought the principal amount down a little bit.
If I could, to Gene, you know, what's the outlook in the coming year on municipal bonds? You know, what's the crystal ball with the underwriters?
So give us your name and address for the record, Gene.
Gene Schultz, Managing Director with Piper Jaffray. My address is 14024 Evans Lane, Sturtevant, Wisconsin. Interest rates. I did a little checking on that today to get kind of a lowdown on where we were and where we are now and where we're going to go. I looked back 1 year and compared it to the rates for today, and the tax-exempt rates have gone up 36%, and that compares almost exactly with the increase in the 10-year Treasury, which went up 37%. Now, the trend is, of course, up. The next question is, will that trend continue? And if I knew that answer, of course, I probably wouldn't be here. I'd be talking to some university or something. But if the economy keeps going good, I will say that the trend will probably continue up. If the economy kind of takes a nosedive, you know, a lot of people are talking recession, then the rates will steady, if not drop. So, you know, I can tell you exactly what happened in the past, but what's going to happen in the future. But the trend is definitely is up. Okay. I still remember when I was finance director for City of Kenosha, and we were looking at a issue for the Kenosha Water Utility. Now, this is a tax-exempt rate. It was 13.5%.
Yeah.
Needless to say, that was refunded a few times, but... and, of course, the Treasury bill, or not the Treasury bill, but Treasury note was at about 16%, and today it's at a 3.21. So, but, of course, it had dropped down to about a 140 if you go back sometime within the last 2 years.
Right.
So, you know, historically we're still in good shape. If you look back 2 years, we're obviously starting to go up.
I mean, those other lower rates, you know, they were real, but they weren't real. I mean, it was.
That's right.
You know, I mean, I don't know how many times in a generation you're going to see rates that low. So.
Right. Heck, especially when we talk about low rates in Europe and Germany especially, they got actually, I mean, it's really hard to believe, negative interest rates. Somebody would have told me that 5 years ago, I'd have probably tried to commit that person.
Yeah.
But that's the truth.
Yeah.
Negative interest rates. But those are starting to change, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
So these are bank qualified because they're issuing under $5 million, is it?
$5 million,
right. Yeah. And interest over the 4 years that we would pay is $94,415.
Now, what makes a bank qualified debt a little bit cheaper, at least as far as your interest rate goes, is that banks that buy them, they can take a deduction on the interest they have to pay to carry those bonds. In other words, if they wanted to borrow $1,380,000 to buy Pleasant Prairie, they can take that interest rate and use it as a deduction on the federal tax form. Otherwise, they would not be able to do it. And the only issuers that can do that are those that issue no more than $5 million in 1 year. So.
Is that national or just Wisconsin?
No, that would be national.
National. I'd move approval of 1844.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
Just for clarification, you said most of the funds for the ambulance were coming out of this. Why not all of it?
When we budgeted for it, we had money in the levy enough to cover it, very small amount.
But okay.
We just set amount at 253 for the borrowing part of it. So we need a roll call vote for the borrowing.
Mike Serpy? Mike Serpy?
Aye.
Dave Klimisch?
Aye.
Mike Polakoff?
Aye.
Chris Keckler?
Aye.
John Steinberg?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you, Kathy. That brings us to item B, and that is consider the proposed 2019 Clean Water Utility, Fleet Internal Service Fund, Solid Waste Utility, Sewer Utility, and Water Utility Budgets.
Okay, John and I are up here giving the presentation for these five budgets. We'll go through each budget and then stop for questions. I don't know if you want to approve the resolution after each one or wait till the end. The first budget we're going to go over is the Clean Water Fund operating budget. This is a summary of the clean water budget. It has what the 2018 budget was, what we're proposing for the 2019, and the dollar changes and the percent changes comparing the 2 years. Revenue for 2019 budget up slightly due to building. As we build, we have more surfaces that we charge the ERUs to. So that's the slight increase there. Operating expense-wise, our total operating expenses are actually up $81,383. The first personnel, the majority of the increase is pension expense. We need to start recording pension or expense in the budgets. In 2018, we didn't budget for pension. That was the first year we had to calculate it. This is a non-cash entry for our participation in Wisconsin retirement. So the majority of the $29,000 is due to pension of $21,732. Contractual services are down $49,000. In 2018, we budgeted for shoreline protection at Lake Andrea for $20,000 and stormwater system planning for $30,000, and neither of those were budgeted for again in 2019. Supplies and maintenance is up. The largest expenses here are being cost of gravel and crushed stone in culvert installation. $39,000 was budgeted in 2019, $10,000 more than we budgeted for these items in 2018. Insurance has a slight increase. Depreciation is budgeted up from 2018 based on historical information. More infrastructure is being depreciated. Non-personnel is up $2,300, which is basically these are the support departments that charge out their operating expenses. It includes IT, finance, HR, administration, and the village clerk. Internal service fund are charges for vehicles and equipment used by the Clean Water Fund, up $42,000, reflecting how 2018 is ending the year. And our contingency, with our increased capitalization limit on infrastructure from $5,000 to $50,000, which started in 2018, we budgeted for that in 2018 at $50,000. We'll continue to budget about $50,000 for contingency for projects that come up that are under $50,000 that need to be expensed. The decision packet is $25,000 for shoreline protection at Lake Andrea. So you can see at the bottom we have a net operating loss a little greater than the previous year. But we have non-cash of depreciation and our pension expense I talked about earlier. Our main concern on these budgets is to keep the cash flow positive, or not, or if it goes down, don't bring it down too much and keep a reserve for future replacement of infrastructure. Here's a graph showing the expense categories. You can see depreciation is our largest expense, which is a non-cash expense, followed by personnel, and then the fleet internal service charge for equipment and vehicles used by this fund. The other ones are very small in comparison, as you can see by the graph. The blue is 2018, and the orange is 2019. These are the non-operating expenses of the Clean Water Fund. The only non-operating expense is interest income, which we're anticipating an increase due to the increase in interest rates being earned on our investments. So we end the year with a negative or a loss of $47,377. As I mentioned before, we're looking for cash flow more than we are for actual gain on the utility. I'll turn this over to John to discuss our decision packets and our capital being recommended.
Good evening, Board. The first thing I'll cover will be the decision packet. There's only one included this year for the Clean Water Utility, Shoreline Protection of Lake Andrea. We did get permits with the Department of Natural Resources to take care of that entire north shoreline, and staff has recommended, Board has approved around $25,000 per year just to kind of tick away a little bit at it so it doesn't take a huge hit. It takes a couple weeks for staff to install it in-house. So we addressed the worst areas on the north side and addressed them accordingly. We can do roughly 300 feet of shoreline protection. Years back in the 90s when the park was first included, they took care of everything on the east, west, and on the south side because the north was a little bit protected. But now erosion has gotten worse over there. And actually, to a point where there's some elevation changes of around 5 feet. So we're addressing the worst areas first, and within a couple of years we should have that all complete. Next I'll talk about some of the capital projects we are recommending. There's five projects. First one is the Beverly Woods storm phase. Engineering department went through and they're in the process of reviewing some survey work and completing design for the Beverly Woods storm component of it. We're estimating, engineers estimate, around $600,000. Half of it would be an accessible price or cost to the everyone the benefits, and then the other half of it, $300,000, would be village component of it. The reason it's half and half is village policy has been anytime that there is some sort of an improvement within the public right-of-way, we take care of it, we maintain it, we replace it when it's exceeded its useful life. So there's around 50% of it that has some fashion of storm sewer, so the village would pick up that cost, and then any additional components of it will be picked up and assessed over the basin. We don't have an exact assessment schedule done yet until design is complete, but just for budgeting purposes, this should put us pretty close to where we need to be. The second one is paving program, clean water adjustments. Anytime that we do work with the paving program within a subdivision, any curb that needs to be replaced, any inlets that need to be replaced or adjusted, any storm pipe that has to be done, we want to take care of that just before the road gets paved during that construction process. So construction management has gone through, identified roughly how many feet of curb, how many inlet structures have to be replaced, and it comes up to an estimate of $120,000. So we do budget that ahead of time. So when the subdivision is paved, it's complete 100%. And you'll see the same thing with the water, with the sanitary sewer also. Next, we have Lake Michigan shoreline protection for $50,000. This year, staff went through and evaluated pretty much the entire shoreline from 128th all the way up to 85th, hired entered into a contract with Clark Dietz, and they did an evaluation of all of these shorelines, rated them like 1 through 5, and took some pictures and documentation just to kind of give us an idea of the severity of the shoreline erosion within Lake Michigan. We did that for the public and for the private. We just received those documents a month or so ago. We're in the process of reviewing them. Next year, what I'd like to do is specifically do some design and engineering on the five outfalls that go into Lake Michigan. They have been failing over the course of the years. So having an engineer take a hard look at what has to be done to fix it 100% to make it right, whether it's some additional jetties or changing it and all the permitting costs. So we are looking at $50,000 for that. The next one is the Chateau Plains stormwater improvements. This has been on the docket for at least 20 years, possibly even longer. Engineering did work very hard along with board and staff, and we did get it permitted for it's permitted now to be done. So we are looking at possibly, you know, they'd have to go through an assessment and all the projects that happen with that. But if that does go through, we're estimating a cost of just over $500,000 to fix those drainage problems in there. And the last one is the Greenway Court culvert replacement. Greenway Court is the road that comes off of Russell Road back to the residential recycling center. There's a cross culvert under there. So before we put the final lift of asphalt on there, it makes sense to replace that culvert. It's a small metal culvert right now that's kind of deteriorated. So we're going to put in a concrete box culvert, and then it should be good for the duration, or at least for the next 50 to 75 years. And those are the decision packets and capital projects for the Clean Water Utility.
As I mentioned, we're concerned about cash flow, so the last slide I have for the Clean Water budget is showing their cash balance. We're estimating to end the year at $2.6 million, up a little bit over $194,000. This proposed budget will actually use that amount plus a little bit more to end 2019 proposed at $2,333,567 estimate of cash balance at the end of the year. This budget is not recommending any increases in fees. So we're looking at any questions on this budget, any of the projects we have here.
I'd recommend adopting Resolution 1839 for the 2019 Clean Water Utility Budget.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
John, I have a question on the Lake Michigan Shoreline Protection. Is that $50,000 a year over several years, or are we expecting $50,000 to do what we need to do for that whole stretch?
We're hoping that the $50,000 will cover the price of engineering and design just for the five outfalls. Okay. The other component for the private and the public, shoreline protection erosion, that study's been complete and it's under staff review before it's final.
Okay.
One thing I can just add to that is right now we kind of have an earmark of $50,000 for shoreline protection out in the future, but that is one thing that it's kind of just an ear. It's just a holding place. We recognize there's probably going to need to be more resources directed that way in order to address the shoreline along Lake Michigan.
Once we have all the studies done, we'll be able to determine the best technique to preserve the shoreline protection. Nathan was just at a conference maybe 6 months ago or 4 months ago when he first started, and actually they had some really innovative things that have been working very well, actually protecting the shoreline from a distance outside of the shore to break the water out there. So we're looking, and it's going to take a little bit of time to evaluate and design and budget. So like Nathan said, we do just have an earmark, but we are trying to find the best solution at the least cost-effective price.
John, I asked this question. If most of the shoreline is pretty much protected, but there's one or two parcels at homes that are no shoreline protection, the lake rises and starts eating away at the shoreline, we're obligated to protect Lakeshore Drive, obviously. If we put the shoreline protection in on that parcel, can we charge that back to that property owner? Or?
In 86 and 87, we had that happen in a number of parcels. In 86 and 87, we had that happen with a number of parcels, and we did charge them. And we had an overall project where we did private and public work, and we assessed everybody that used the village materials that we had at that time, as well as the contractor that did the installation. But as they go, what happens is the house is gone, and then it takes some more time, and then until it gets to the right-of-way, we don't have a legal basis to go and get it. But, it's coming up, but I'm not sure, Benny, and you guys have done the study, recently with Clark Dietz, how much is getting close to the right-of-way from
those private parcels.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually surprised on how good the shoreline was protected all the way on that stretch from 85th to 128th. And like Trustee Serpy said, there were some areas that are not protected, and we can address that with the residents and give them options of what to do once the report is reviewed and complete.
But your question is relevant in the sense of what is the correct policy and the correct approach to pay for these improvements. You know, who is supposed to bear the burden of the cost? Is it the general taxpayer, or is it something that is more specific to the property owner? And so those are questions that we're going to need to evaluate. We have kind of a placeholder, if you will, because we're trying to, you know, be cognizant and aware of the needs that are going to be coming down the pike. But clearly we recognize that nowadays $50,000 doesn't buy you much, so...
Okay, we had a motion and a second. Further discussion? Hearing none? Just a regular vote on these?
Yeah.
Roll call. Okay. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Kathy?
Okay, our next budget is Fleet Internal Service Fund. Again, here's a comparison of our 2018 budget to the 2019 for the Fleet Internal Service Fund with dollar changes and percent changes. Revenue, we're keeping the same in the base budget. We are recommending increase as one of our decision packets. Operating expenses is up $100,000 for personnel. That's because we added a fourth mechanic, and we, again, added some pension expense of $16,892 to this budget that was not budgeted in 2018. Contractual services, it's all due to contractual equipment and vehicle maintenance being up $19,000. Supplies and maintenance, fuel budgeted up $22,000, offset by a reduction in equipment and vehicle maintenance supplies of $35,000. Insurance is pretty much the same, not up only $1,000. Depreciation is budgeted at historical levels and has decreased slightly by $40,000. Decision packets, well, fleet's pretty similar, up $2,000, and then decision packets of $33,000 is the revenue for a 2% increase in fleet charge out that we're recommending. Here are our categories in a graph format. You can see, again, depreciation is one of our larger expenses because of the assets we hold in this utility. And then it's followed by supplies and maintenance to maintain these vehicles and equipment, and then personnel to also maintain these vehicles and equipment. Supplies and maintenance of supplies and maintenance includes minor equipment, fuel, equipment supplies, and vehicle maintenance supplies. That's the second biggest category here. And all the rest are a lot smaller than those three major categories I just talked about. These are our non-operating expenses in this utility. This one also has interest income, which is up due to the interest rates being up. And then also when we trade in or sell vehicles, when we get new vehicles, we get a small gain on the sale of these vehicles, which we're budgeting in similar to what we had last year of $3,500 net gain on the vehicles. So this fund does have a positive gain of proposed at $107,840, but it's down from the year before $31,000. But I did mention this recommended increase of 2% to cover operating costs of the fleet internal service fund, like inflation, and to just keep up and not fall behind in that area. We've done this for the last couple years, and we'll continue if we can in the future, depending on how our budgets are going. And John, if you want to go over your fleet capital request.
Thank you, Kathy. The items that we're looking this year is we always earmark some money for vehicles at an auction. We do go to a public auction down south And we've had very good luck over the last 10 years purchasing some equipment that we may not put a lot of miles or a lot of hours on, but it's very useful to have, or we won't have to contract it out. Or chipper trucks. There's been other large chassis, elevated boom trucks, stuff like that. And so we have it general because you never really know what's going to be at the auction, how much things are going to go for. So we just earmark some money for that, and we've been very successful with that. We are looking at replacing some larger pickup trucks, purchasing a used rear loader garbage truck, not the one with the arms on the side, but the one that picks up the large containers in the rear, building a plow truck with the used cabin chassis. So that's another item where we'll go through and we'll buy some piece of equipment that has a chassis that's very similar to what we need for a snowplow truck that's 7 years old, it's very clean. Take off whatever is on the back of that existing piece of infrastructure, resell that at auction, then put the new plow equipment on it. We save about $40,000-$50,000 a year by doing that. The chassis are very clean, and it's been working out well for us. So we plan to continue to do that. A zero-turn lawnmower, replacing our combination backhoe with the mini excavator, replacing a vehicle for the appraisal department in the fleet, and possibly a van for the Recplex would be the items that we're looking to get, or some of the items we buy at auction, some of them we buy used, and some of them we buy off of the state bid contract, depending on the best fit for the fleet. And that's all I have for the fleet internal service.
Okay, the last slide we hear here on the fleet budget is our cash balances. Currently, we're estimating to end the year at $928,000. And our proposed budget increases the cash balance slightly to end 2019 at $975,000. I'm looking for approval of resolution 1840, which would increase our charges by 2% to the other enterprise funds and the general government when they use the vehicles and equipment.
I'll move that, but I got a question on it also.
I'll second it.
We have a motion, a second, Mike.
I know we've excluded the fire equipment, the pumpers and the tankers and the ambulances from that. But have we taken a look back at what, like the fire trucks, the pickup trucks and the chief's vehicles, as well as have we done an evaluation on those as well as the police vehicles for maintenance? And
as far as completing the maintenance within house, we have not done it, but it's something I could talk with the chiefs about.
I'd like to see that next year. I think right now I don't think the fund could afford to buy the fire equipment, but if they're going to buy another grass truck or replace the fire chief's SUVs or well as the police cars, I think it's time to give it another look-see and see whether or not we can do it at a cost-effective rate for the fund and for the departments.
Would you be looking at actually having those vehicles in the fleet, maintaining them, having them
right,
them pay for them and charge out, but just not the large pieces of apparatus? Is there a request?
Well, if we had unlimited money, we'd take the large too, but I don't think we have the money to do it.
Right, you are correct.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can definitely work with the two chiefs and we can see if we can come up with something with Nathan and Kathy
for next year.
The only thing I'd add to that, Mike, is just being cognizant that sometimes, and I don't know where John's staff is as far as training and so forth for the larger pieces of apparatus, but it's something that we can consider. I know that that's not what you've specifically asked, but just to be aware of that there might be some specialties that might be required to as we evaluate that. So
we have a motion, a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Kathy?
Now we continue with our solid waste fund budget. Again, I have similar slides that I did for clean water and fleet. This first slide shows our comparison, what we're proposing versus 2018. Operating revenue, we had a decrease of $17,000. The biggest decrease is in our recycling rebate of $42,800, offset by an increase in a couple of the other revenue categories. The recycling rebate that we received from our recycling company has pretty much disappeared due to the market. Operating expense-wise, we're down $61,000 overall. First of all, depreciation is up based on historical trends by $4,000. Office supplies are down slightly, $1,600. Compost site expense is up $8,000, mainly due to labor and contractual services, offset by a reduction in fleet. Administrative costs are up $33,000, mainly because of the pension expense that I mentioned in the other two budgets of $29,947. We did not budget for this last year. It was the first year it was implemented, and this is also a non-cash accounting entry for the Wisconsin Retirement System. Leaf collection is up slightly by $4,861, or 4.9%. Recycling expense is up $38,000, mainly due to tipping of $12,000 and contractual services grinding up $22,000. Garbage expense is down, mainly due to personnel reductions. Our decision packets, which we'll talk about in the next couple of slides, would bring in additional revenue of $123,321. We're still looking with that increase in revenue sources. We're still looking at an operating loss of $85,000 for this utility. Again, remember, we're looking at cash flow, not as much as operating loss. Here's our categories we have. You can see our biggest expense category is garbage collection, being budgeted at $818,739 for 2019, followed by recycling collection and administration cost. And then the other categories fall into place with leaf collection, compost expense, office supplies, and depreciation. Non-operating, we have our grant, which is our hazardous waste grant and our recycling grant. The biggest portion of this is our recycling grant. The smaller portion, around $10,000-$11,000, is our hazardous waste grant. We're looking at just a slight reduction of $145 for budgeting based on what we got this year. And then interest expense, again, is up slightly due to our increased interest earnings. John, if you want to go through these recommendations for decision packets.
Thank you, Kathy. We are looking at three decision packets. The first one is yard waste acceptance. When we were negotiating our contract for our solid waste and our recycling with Advanced Disposal, they did bring out the possibility that they have a municipality just over the border that would, you know, be considering to bring their yard waste into the RC. So they would collect it with a large rear loader truck and then just bring one of those rear load trucks into the RC every day. That would generate, you know, if we can make this happen, it would generate around $40,000 of additional revenue. We estimate around $5,000 of grinding, processing, turning, all that stuff. So it would be a net gain of $35,000 if we can make that work. So I think it was something worth entertaining. I contacted the DNR to make sure they were okay with it, with our permit. They said as long as we stay underneath our 20,000 cubic yards of volume at one point, they'd be okay with it. They really didn't have a problem. We have plenty of room within our permit, plenty of room within our physical sprays, and if we can generate some additional funds with it without that much labor involved, it seems like at least something to bring before the board. Second one we have is installing lights in the residential recycling center drive. That's Greenway Court. That's the same road they were looking at doing the culvert. Prairie Produce is proposing to come in just to the east of the residential recycling center. If that does happen, that road will actually open up all the way through to the end where the recycling is. That gate will go away. The development will pay for a cul-de-sac and actually streetlights along there. So once that development happens, the development will pay for those improvements. If that development does not happen, those improvements will not happen. That's why it's a $0 cost. And the second one are normalizing the fees at the residential recycling center. We have noticed that we have not been covering our costs, and we haven't raised any of our white goods or tires or bulk probably almost since we started the solid waste 13 years ago now that it's been. So we are looking at increasing the bulk cost. So actually, right now you can bring as much bulk as you want for free. We're finding out that, you know, we're really getting a lot of bulk in there, and then by the time we handle it, we haul it to the landfill, we're really losing some money. So all we're trying to do is just make a wash out of that. So what staff is proposing to do is the first cubic yard, so the first 3x3x3 or whatever you can haul in the back of a pickup truck, roughly, you know, or like the trunk of a SUV, is free. No charge for that. For every cubic yard in addition that you bring to that, it's $7. So if you come in with a big trailer of stuff because you cleaned out the garage, it may cost you $14 to get rid of it, but the village has a cost to have that. If there's someone that, you know, a contractor that may be doing something where they're not supposed to be dumping it, at least we're capturing some money with that also. We are looking at bumping up the cost of the white goods 20% just to cover our costs that it takes to get rid of a refrigerator or a dehumidifier, because those prices have been creeping up over the years. And then the tires, we are looking at, you know, raising the price of tires to just cover our cost of what we are, and actually breaking the tires up into three different categories. So we'll have just your residential car tire, like in a minivan. You'll have your pickup truck tire, and believe it or not, we do get some semi-tires or front-end loader tires. So based on the average weight of each of those tires, we know how much the landfill is charging us to recycle those, and so we're just looking to cover our costs with that. And then the balance of it, we would be looking to do an increase on the sticker, an increase on the monthly fee, $1, just to cover the increase in the tipping fee that we have, the increase in the fuel, the increase in everything else that's associated within the solid waste, just to cover those costs. We have not had an increase in probably 3-4 years, but that tipping fee, which is up around $300,000-$400,000 per year, goes up incrementally from $45 to $48 to $54. And if you take the amount of tons that we have, all of a sudden that utility starts to lose money. So we're just looking to keep up with our big ticket expenses that we really have no control over, and just pass those on to the users as listed out within the decision packet.
And before you go on, a question on the yard waste acceptance. We're not having a problem getting rid of the composting and everything else that we presently have?
Right now, we've been able to get rid of everything that we do produce in there. We have not been screening anymore. We did stop the screening operation because our screener was getting very expensive to maintain. So we actually sold the screener, and we've just been handing it out unscreened. It's still a good project, a still product at the end of the day. One of the things that we are looking to do is the contractor that comes in to grind our compost, so when you take the leaves and the brush and the grass, you grind it all together, and that kind of starts a compost process. He has another machine, a screener he could bring out, so we could screen a small amount and possibly charge your bag or try to generate some revenue out of that product. So we'll look at, you know, starting that a little bit, just small scale, to see how much of a demand is there for screen compost where there's a nominal fee versus unscreened that you may get for free.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, your $1 increase, when you consider the services that you're providing the village with garbage, with solid waste recycling, the use of the recycling center, I don't know what does it come out to, $17, $18 a month now?
Yeah, it's like $17.50, so raising it will be one more dollar. And there's also hazardous waste, there's right. Curbside leaf collection.
That's something we couldn't get from the private carrier.
If you would try to charge that out, it would be much more expensive much more. With all the services that we do provide for the village residents.
I give you credit for bringing that forward.
Thank you.
It's a good move.
I agree that, you know, charging on the bulk is good. I've been out there, I was out there one time and I was bringing some weeds out, and a guy had a low boy, And he brought, that thing was packed. There was like a garage he demolished, and but that was his bulk. And we were, in the way it's structured now, you know, we end up having to load up that whole garage that's been torn down and haul it off at no cost. And he dropped it off on us.
Right.
He had a Village sticker on his truck and for when he brings his own personal stuff. But, I mean, some of that stuff gets tough to handle. So if we can, I agree with you. I think it's a good idea because it's, you know, this is really meant to make it easy for people on a basic, you know,
correct,
week, whatever they have at their place, they can get rid of it. But, you know, not to facilitate the demolition of.
And everyone can still bring in a cubic yard,
right, yeah,
of solid waste per day. And if that person that, you know, so let's say I have a garage on my personal property that I take down and I load it up on a truck and I want to get rid of it, at least now I'm going to weigh, is it just easier just to run to the landfill on my own and do it, right, or take it and haul it off? And, you know, so it, I think it's something that's going to be a good decision packet to have for the utility.
I think that's a lot fair for the ratepayers.
Absolutely.
Just a point of clarification, though, I think, because this slide isn't exactly clear. One of the things that we were, as staff, we were bouncing around, and the $88,000 was based on a thought process of potentially charging for the sticker itself to enter into the recycling center. Since that point, we've gotten some feedback that probably would not be the best practice or the best policy moving forward. And so with that, that's the reason for suggesting that we're going to need to do some type of rate increase on the monthly bill. So it's not necessarily exactly clear in the slide, but I just wanted to clarify that point, that in order for us to make up the difference, if we were to get rid of a kind of a user fee for the recycling center, we're going to need to have some type of difference made up in the rates itself.
I did have a couple questions. The yard waste acceptance agreement with our neighbors here, you'd mentioned that even with what's expected to come, we're still well below our allowance annually. Is that right?
Yeah, they would be proposing to bring in one rear load around 13 cubic yards of material, and they would just be tipped per truckload that they bring in on average.
Is this something
of 13 cubic yards?
Is this something that could be expanded if it's deemed successful? Is this on a
trial
basis?
Expanded. Yeah, I mean, it could be expanded. Answer your question, yes.
Is this
as long as we stay under our 20,000 cubic yards of material in the site at one point as permitted by the DNR.
Okay. And then the contractual obligation, is it just on a trial basis, a month-to-month to see how it works?
We have not finalize the contract yet. We're still in the negotiating stage of it. So if it works out, I mean, I would like to try it for 1 year, evaluate it, and then we can go for a multiple-year contract and actually expanding out with other municipalities down the road.
I think it's a really good idea and obviously a good use of our resources and for some type of net gain as well. My other question I had with the diversion rate for recycling, and I saw in some of the narrative that it's declined still a little bit and
there's
still the expectation to have increased education out in the residential areas. But that seems to be the trend, though, the last couple of years, that overall the community of Pleasant Prairie hasn't been recycling more and more as hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare us with other municipalities, I think any time you have this single-stream recycling, your diversion rate is going to be a little bit higher, meaning that, you know, if you give them an easy access to a large container where it's not a lot of work for the resident, where you take your paper and your plastic and your cans, everything, put them in one container, then it's just taken care of. That works out a lot easier. We do have a lot of people that actually fill that 95-gallon recycling, and it's just human nature that once that recycling container is full, oh, there's one right next to it that's got a little bit of space, throw it in there. So we do offer an additional recycling container, no charge, and I've been actually working with Nathan and Emily on some public education, and one of the ideas was, you know, doing a magnet. So a magnet that gets out in the fridge that says, here's some of the items, really doing some PSAs on social media, which has been very proactive, on the website, just really getting the word out. We try to get within the schools to talk to the kids, because you'll be surprised how much impact that the kids have, even when the parents don't recycle, like, hey, Dad, wait a minute, that's supposed to go in the other container, you know, so that happens a lot too. So we're trying to get out, get some public education out to get that diversion rate up and save the utility some money at the end of the day.
And I'm not pushing for this right now. I just know of other communities that have instituted some type of fee just because of the community not being able to address the recycling needs and expectations. I'm only asking in the sense, do we know if that's existed in any place where that's deemed to have been a positive impact, that it deterred people away from, you know, taking more accountability to recycling?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are looking at doing some RFID readers, which we'll be getting into with the capital. So at least we'll know if some people are not recycling whatsoever. I think the public education is going to help. And I think at the end of the day, it's almost just a generational thing where, you know, back 40, 50 years ago, there was no recycling. And so, you know, and now all the younger kids kind of grew up with recycling. So I think as generation gets older, I think it's just that diversion rate is going to increase also. One of the things that we talked about earlier was the amount that we spend on the tipping fees. Mm-hmm. So if we can just educate people and just really push that point home over and over again that whatever goes into recycling that we get paid for doesn't have to go in the landfill that we're paying the $64 a ton. So if you can change 10 ton, 100 ton, 1,000 tons, now you're talking some serious money that hopefully in the future, you know, will eliminate any need for increases. But if our diversion rate stays a little bit lower and then we're forced to pay the additional tipping fees and we're, you know, the additional tonnages at the landfill.
Thank you.
I don't believe we had a motion yet. Yep. We do have a motion and a second?
No, I don't think so.
We don't have a motion.
You're not done.
We're not done. Yeah, we're not all the way done. That was just a decision package for capital.
Yeah.
And the next one that we have is the capital. We do have one item in capital recommended, and that's getting 3 RFID readers within our solid waste trucks. Our solid waste carts do have the technology to know that, hey, I've been tipped or I haven't been tipped whatsoever. And so a tip is any time that the garbage truck picks it up, dumps it in the truck, and puts it back on the ground is a tip. We actually, you know, with this would have the technology in place to know this cart was tipped on this day at this time. It does a couple of things for the utility. One, it lets us know that people are recycling. It lets us know that if someone calls to say, hey, my garbage wasn't picked up, well, we drove by, it just wasn't out, and, you know, it saves us some time transporting stuff like that. So we are looking to get to a point where we have all the RFID tags within the carts and then the readers in the trucks with ultimate goal to know if somebody never puts their recycling cart out but they always have a garbage cart out, it's costing everyone within that utility money because now everyone has to pay for someone else's recycling going within the garbage. And so we'll send out some public education as phase 1. We'll send them out a letter, phase 2, and then we do have the authority through the DNR to issue them a citation if someone is just not compliant to recycle. Haven't had that problem yet, but we really don't have the technology to track it. So hopefully this will be something that we can do to keep our diversion rate high, to keep as much material out of the landfill as we can, and ultimately keep our rates lower for everyone within the utility.
Do you have the capacity to weigh the recycle bin to see if it's empty or full or half full?
That's technology that's being developed right now, but it has a hard time, you know, weighing something. You know, when just this, the weight of the arm and everything else on there could weigh 1,000 pounds to weigh recycling cart, you know, where the material inside may only weigh 10, 15 pounds. That variance is so small. So I think as technology catches up, you know, with it, there will be a point, and it's called pay as you throw is what it's called. So as much as you actually put into the truck is how you're charged down the road. We're not there yet. That's something that the solid waste industry is developing for solid waste and for recycling. I think it's a ways out there yet. I'm not sure how far, but
I suppose somewhere in that technology is a screenshot of what's being dumped also.
that technology is out there also. We actually have four cameras within every garbage truck.
Right.
One in the rear, one on each of the sides to assist the drivers, and one actually in the hopper. And so we do know if someone is, if someone has yard waste in their recycling or something like that, you know, then they can pull it out or we can sticker them or issue them a citation. Okay. And that is the last of the capital that I have for the solid waste fund.
Okay, we end this budget also with a cash balance report. We're looking at estimating ending 2018 at $206,000, a little over. And then with this budget, it would increase our cash by a little less than $60,000 to end the year at $266,440. That will adjust a little bit more, just a little bit based on our discussion tonight of not charging for compost stickers, but to add a dollar fee per month onto the utility bill. The resolution will have to be changed also because it's not phased, not written that way. So resolution number 1841, instead of it would read the third paragraph down, whereas adoption of the solid waste utility budget require a dollar per month increase in the monthly billing effective during 2019 when water and sewer rates are changed and increase of other fees at the residential recycling center. So we are also looking at fee analysis on both the sewer and water utility, and I'm recommending that this dollar increase doesn't happen until the water rates are approved. Then the sewer rate should be done at that same time, and then we'll add the $1 to the bill, the monthly bills. Every time you make even a little change on the bills, even a dollar, you get a lot of phone calls coming in asking why my utility bill has changed. Because we have a lot of flat bills out there in terms of people that don't have water, but they have a sewer flat, and then everything else is very similar. So I'm looking for a recommendation on the modified resolution 1841.
So moved on 1841 with the modified language.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Then a roll call. Not a roll call. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Kathy?
Okay, now I have the sewer and then the water budget. I have some slides at the end of this, these budgets that kind of talk about overall utilities, so if we want to hold off to the end to approve the two remaining resolution for both the sewer and water. Here's a summary of the sewer utility. I made it a little more summarized than the other budgets because there's a lot of detail underneath especially the operating expenses of this budget. So I will just hit the high points of the operating expenses and operating revenues. Again, the same comparison, 18 budget to 2019 proposed. Our operating revenue is up 2019 by $312,000. The majority of this is in the industrial surcharge at $200,000. There's more customers that we are sampling and billing. So this has caused this area to increase. Operating expenses, an increase of $269,000 when compared to your 2018 budget. Treatment expenses up $200,000. Depreciation, non-cash is up $20,000 in that category. So those are the major changes in all of our expense categories. The sewer budget is very detailed and is in your budget packets in the agenda, showing each of the different categories we have. Non-operating interest expense. This is interest expense on debt netted against interest income on investments. And capital contributions, we just estimate $100,000. So interest is down. The interest we pay for our debt is down $26,000. Interest income that we earn is up $50,000 for an increase in revenue of $76,000 that's shown on the slide. Decision packets, which John will go over shortly in the next couple slides, is actually a total of $104,000 worth of requests. These, again, are operating revenues on this that shows our different categories of where our revenue is coming in. Residential is one of our bigger categories at $2.6 million, or 41% of our budget. The second biggest is industrial. at 2.6% or 40% of our budget. This includes the $1 million surcharge and, well, $1 million for last year and $1.2 million for this year being proposed in 2019. Our third category is commercial at a little over $1,150,000 or 18% of our revenue budget. And public authority stays the same at 1% or $62,000 of the revenue sources we have for utilities. Operating expenses, breakdown again, treatment expense is our largest category at $2.2 million being proposed for 2019, or 41% of our expenses. Kenosha Water Utility charges the village for sewer treatment. Personnel is $0.9 million or 17% of our budget. This includes both our operational personnel, clerical, and administration allocations. Depreciation is a little over $1.4 million, or 28% of our revenue or our expense. This recognizes the cost of the infrastructure over its useful life. This is a non-cash expense when recognized, and infrastructure is either donated by developers or installed and paid by special assessments. The other category is 11%, or a little over $589,000 for 2019. This includes our electrical of $77,000, other contractual services, supplies, and phone, etc. ISF, which is Fleet Internal Service Fund charges, is $172,000, or 3%. It's for the use of our vehicles and equipment by the sewer utility. I'll turn it over to John to talk about our decision packets and capital programs being recommended.
Thank you, Kathy. We do have six decision packets. The first one that we have are purchasing three more sewer samplers. Like she talked about with some of the increased revenue with the sanitary surcharge, currently we're limited to the nine samplers that we have, and we can only sample 3 days a week. So by the time you drop a sampler in, pick it up on Tuesday, pick it up Wednesday, pick it up on Thursday, you can really only get three because the lab only works on certain days. We're sampling around 66 per month right now. We like to sample over 100 sites just to make sure that anyone that has a high BOD, which is a concentration of the sewer, any additional solids or high phosphorus levels in their sample, we're capturing those and sending them a bill because the village has to pay for that when it hits the meter on 7th Avenue going into City Kenosha. So purchasing those three additional samplers for the $15,000 hopefully brings us in that additional $312,000 in our revenue. The next one that we have, it does say repave Bentzlis lift station, but we are looking just to add security fencing around Bentzlis lift station for the same price of $15,000 and also adding some security fencing around 192 lift station. Bent's lift station is just to the north of the Prank Center around the 8500 block of Highway 31. And then the 192 lift station is around the 6800 block of 88th Avenue. The part-time utility to full-time position is taking a year-round part-time position from part-time to full-time. And that position will be funded, or the additional increase will be funded 50% by water, 50% by sewer. The next one is the technical support DPW crew lead. So currently we have five field staff in our Department of Technical Services. Maybe let's just back up just a quick second. Our sewer and water divisions, they have a maintenance division, which takes care of cleaning the sewer mains, installing the water, any of the dirty field work. And then we actually have a technical service, the guys that read the meters, the guys that take the chlorine residuals, that take all the samples, any requirements that we have by the PSC, by the DNR, anything that, you know, a little, that staff is generally a little bit more educated. I believe they all have college degrees. The maintenance guys are just really good at running backhoes and, you know, driving truck and laying pipe and stuff like that. So we do have a utility division and a technical service division, just as a little bit of a background. So we do have the five field personnel, but they really don't have a crew leader out in the field. So we're proposing the just over $10,000 to have four field personnel and the one crew lead. That crew lead will still be a working position out in the field, but it'll be that one person that you can go to with questions. If there's a problem, you know, you can go right to that working crew lead instead of having to go to myself or to Tom or anyone else in administration. And then the last one is developing a sanitary sewer master plan. This was in the plan for this year, but with everything going on, we just didn't have a chance to get to, so it's kind of a carryover. We did develop a water master plan, which we're actually hoping to have finalized within the next month, and then the next one will be the sanitary sewer master plan. So as the village develops, where are the sanitary sewers going to go? Where do the lift stations have to go to make sure the interceptor mains are sized right as development comes around? So that is something we'd like to have for the decision packet. We do have four capital projects recommended. The first one is the Highway 50 sewer rehab. The state is looking to reconstruct Highway 50, as I'm sure many of you know, from four-lane to six-lane. I believe year one starts at I-94, and then it works east a ways. A lot of this work will be for rehabbing this, or not so much rehabbing the sewer, but at least determining what work has to be done and developing some design, some planner profile, so we can have a cost in future years. So before Highway 50 gets done, we can have the sewer done just a year ahead of it, or at least while that's being constructed. So we're allocating some money for that. The sewer rehab to reduce I&I. Over the last 10 years, we have been going down and taking $200,000-$300,000 per year and just kind of piecing away at the sewer lining, the manhole reconstruction, the grouting around the connections. We are looking at just going and finishing this all off in one contract. We do feel that we'll get a better price. The sewer utility is in a financial position where it does have the funds available to do it. So we are looking to finish this off. And that is about just under 12 miles of sanitary sewer main to have lined. It would be grouting of just under 800 connections and then just some spot repairs. And then there's... Then for manholes, we do have 317 manholes that would be sealed and grouted. And so there would be some savings by the lack of infiltration that would be coming into the system, which everything that we treat, and then this project would just be complete. So we only do this project on clay mains. So but back in the day, you know, they would take a 3-foot piece of clay main, shove it in, a little bit of tar, shove another one. Well, it's going to leak. It's going to crack. The technology out there since probably the mid to late 80s was PVC. A PVC, it doesn't leak, it doesn't crack, it's just a much more stable product. There's two different ways that you can maintain this clay main. You can, one, you can go down and open up the road and open up the trench and you can dig it all up and just put a new PVC. It's very, very costly to do that. A technology that's been out for probably a couple decades now, we've been doing it for probably 10 years, is a sewer lining. And you guys are all familiar, I believe, with the sewer lining process. We did it in the Cooper Road drainage basin, and it worked great. Most people in the neighborhood really had no idea that their sewer was relined, that the manholes were done. They come in with a truck, they put in a liner from the manhole, they invert it with epoxy, they steam it, they fill it up with water, it seals, they cut some holes for the laterals, they grout it, and it's been very successful. So we would just like to finish up that process this year for the $3.3 million and just reline all of our clay, grout all the laterals that are associated with it, and reline all of our sanitary manholes. The next one that I have is rebuilding a lift station, Slater's Lift Station on 39th Avenue. Village staff has been going through every year and just rebuilding one of the older lift stations. A lot of our lift stations happen around the late 80s, 90s, and they just exceeded the useful life. The reason I like doing it with in-house staff is that it's a great training program for our utility to build a wet well, to put in the pumps, to do the transducers, to do all the electronics and all the mechanics that go with it. And when something goes wrong with that lift station in the future, the staff knows exactly how to repair it, because they built it. So I believe this will be lift station number 7 now that we're doing. It's worked out great. Back probably in 2000, we were going out every day, every other day for a call of a bad pump, a bad flow, something going on. those calls are far and few between now because we've been maintaining, rebuilding these lift stations, using these funds. We have a great maintenance program, so it's really been working out well. Last one that I have is the paving program sewer adjustments. Like we talked about, any time that we do a road paving program, we make sure that the barrel section is good, the cone is good, the rings are sealed, the casting is good, any adjustments that have to be made. That's really the time to address it is during the construction process, the paving program process. So we're estimating around $170,000 to maintain the sewer that's included under the boundaries of the paving program for next year. And then the last one that I have is split between sewer and water under our historian. That's our more database end of our SCADA. SCADA is a system that we use that monitors the lift stations, the remote meters, the water tower stuff. We are looking to add SCADA to the post office lift station. So when there is a problem with that now, instead of having a dialer call or having somebody see a red light on a panel to call in, now we'll actually know real time that there's a problem, address it, and then we can, you know, be much more responsive with any issues that may come up. That's all I have for the capital.
John, I have a question for you.
Yes.
In the springtime, we get heavy rainfalls in the area of, in the whole village, but in the area of Cooper Road in the 8,000-8100 block, we're getting constant backups in the basements. I don't know if it's our fault, a combination of our fault with the city not being able to convey enough sewage in the lines. Is there anything in the works that's going to address this?
Well, the parts of the sanitary sewer that we've addressed so far is we've addressed the main, and, you know, we reline the mains, we've sealed the manholes, and then we've sealed the actual connections. The last point of that system to the house is the sanitary lateral. So there's still most of those homes have a clay lateral, or I say most of them, but a lot of those 300 homes in that basin still have a clay lateral. The next part of the process, once all the lining is done, will be to either re-excavate, put in PVC, or reline the laterals. I'm not proposing that in part of this budget right now because there was a patent pending on that process of the laterals, and I believe that patent is up this year or next year. So I'm presuming that once the patent is up, more contractors will be available to do it. That price is going to go from the $75 a foot that it is now, hopefully to much less. And so we still have to address the lateral component of it. And I think we need to go back and reinspect the homes on a regular basis. There are some people that, you know, anytime that there's sump pump, it starts getting to the top or they can't run it out the window or run it out their sump pump line. They put it right into a floor drain, which is tied into the sanitary sewer. Some people do it on a spot when it big rains. Other people just have it plumbed in direct. So we'll catch them on inspections, but we need to get in the house, you know, to do that. So the sanitary sewer is really only designed just for your residential use, your toilet, your bathtub, your sinks, any water that you have. Once you start discharging a sump pump into there, or two, three people out of 300 do it, the next thing you know, the person at the bottom of the hill around that 8100 block, that becomes the available storage once the pipe is full, is their basement. And so I think a combination of getting the mains, the manholes, and the connections sealed up, then doing the laterals sealed up, whether it's a lining or it's a replacement, and then finally just doing that inspection to make sure that everyone is compliant. And there's ways that we can video in the main to see if a sump pump is discharging out a lateral. We can do dye tests and stuff like that. So we'll probably become more aggressive and some sort of preventative measures to make sure that that's not happening within the sanitary sewer.
Is there any chance that the city could be causing some of the not having enough capacity down wherever it goes, 75th Street or 80th Street, wherever it's going?
One of the things that we are going to look at is the actual velocity of the sewer at the meter around that 7900 block. So the way that the sewer meter works is that it just shoots a beamer, it measures the elevation of the water in the main at the meter at a specific manhole. Well, the one point that it's missing is that, you know, how fast, what's the velocity in feet per second that it's moving through that main. So if the city is backed up, that means that, you know, so the water level is going up, but if it's not moving, you know, then it becomes a city problem that we need to address. So we are looking to evaluate that over the next month, 6 months, something like that, to, you know, there's some special meters that we can get to do. And then we'll have to work out something with the city of Kenosha if that is the case. I don't know if it is or not, but we are always looking at ways to make sure that our customers are served.
A couple questions. One is, I think that, you know, the city's going through some I&I work in that Forest Park neighborhood, and I think it's on around 57th. I mean, they actually are bypassing from the sanitary sewer right to the storm sewer because it's, I mean, they set the pump up when they know it's going to rain because it doesn't.
Yeah, right around 67th to 57th, yeah. They have a pumps right out there every time.
I think that that area is, you know, my experience over the years is that it does backflow into the system. And I think, you know, you're right on right track to get that different meter. When my other question is, I looked at our treatment flows for this year, and they were up. Any feeling for what the ratio is from new growth to precipitation? We had a pretty wet year.
Are you talking about why our treatment costs were up or why our volumes are up, you're saying?
Well, it's both. I mean,
all right. All right, well, we did have a situation with one of our users within the industrial park that did have some very high BODs, and it was a large water user. So we did work with them. They've corrected the problem. The money that we collected within the surcharge through the random sampling, we ended up going from a monthly random sample to a daily sample every day. We worked with the company very closely, and we were actually able to assist them to get their surcharge back down.
Okay.
So that's worked out well, but that was probably $600,000
okay.
of additional cost. So right. that's something that happened this year that we incurred on the expense side, but we did offset it on the revenue side. We did have a wet year this yeah. year. As far as inches of rain, I don't have that number available right now, but or generally speaking, anytime that there is a wet year, you're going to have more infiltration. Anytime you have more infiltration, it ends up down at 7th Avenue on the meter. We do have staff that we try to, anytime it's really wet after big rain, we'll start popping manhole lids and just looking for leaks somewhere.
Right.
So you can see them in the manholes easy. A little bit harder to see in the main.
Right.
So then the guys are trained to, when you look at one manhole, if it's a quarter pipe full, if you go to the next manhole and it's half a pipe full, you know, chances are there's some sort of infiltration at the pipe. We'll send out a video crew. If we need to do a lining or an excavation to repair it, we'll do that. We would like to do more of that down the road, and I think by having these additional full-time employees will allow us to do some of those additional proactive measures to keep our infiltration and hence our costs down.
Another thing I'd like to recommend, you know, as you start doing that work is I think on Cooper Road, I mean, I'm ready to put up the white flag. We've gone through and we've evaluated all the footings and foundations, drains that were going to sanitary sewer. We have that completed. And we provided a grant of $600 to each home to get a sump pump in that didn't have a sump pump in. And we had another one of $1,000 to disconnect the perimeter tile from the sanitary sewer. But I really believe there's a fundamental basic flaw on Cooper Road from 83rd, probably to 79th, and primarily on the west side of the road. I don't think the elevation between the basements on that side of the road and the sewer main is that much different. And I think that, you know, we ought to take a look at to deal with that is get them to suspend their plumbing in their houses. Get that, just identify that, and we just need to go in and we know what the elevations are. We need to get a floor elevation in those places, and I think that's going to be the thing that's going to take care of it. If they still have some sewage coming in their house, it's because they, you know, they got some backflow, you know, around their perimeter tile that was connected. But, you know, that sewer was the second sanitary sewer that was put in the town of Pleasant Prairie. It was pretty old, and my experience with those things is they were engineered on the back of a legal pad, and just whipped them in. So we could spend a lot of money trying to get a lot of things done out there, and we have done a lot of things. I think it's you know, maybe it's time for the, at least where we have the basement problems, is to say, okay, you can't provide basement service out there. So you have to go to grinder pump or suspend their plumbing. They'll be a lot happier. We'll be happier. And I think it ends that problem because cities, you know, they're at their lowest point where we connect. They can't go any lower so that we can make our line any lower. So, you know, we have what we have. Our only option is to relay the whole sewer system and run it south. And I don't think anybody wants to do that.
And you are correct with everything you said between that 79 to 8300 block, primarily on the east side of the road. There's not a very big elevation change from the basements to the elevation of the sanitary sewer. So when we go down by the meter, which is very close at 7900 block, once it surcharges a couple feet up over the top of the main, we know that it's getting really close to entering those basements. So then we take some reactive measures to make sure that that doesn't happen. We'll actually pump water out of there.
Right.
And you're also correct by, you know, the best way to fix that is either to hang that sewer and then put in a grinder pump for your floor drain or any or bathroom, because now you're raising that gradient or the elevation from, you know, ground zero at the floor up to maybe 3-4 feet.
Right.
And so now instead of surcharging when it's 1 or 3 feet up, it almost have to be 6, 7, 8 feet, which it never right. gets to. So that's something that we can work with those residents. I mean, if they're willing, and I would assume if they're having problems, they would be willing to
right.
let us in, to take some elevations, to do a little bit of engineering, and to come up with some sort of a program to assist them. Because it has been a problem ever since I can remember. So,
right.
And probably ever since it's been built, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that'd be money well spent.
We're going to make a motion when we do water, right? Are we done with sanitary sewer?
Yeah, at the end.
Yeehaw.
So this is the sewer debt. Right now, at the end of 2019, they'll have a little over $2,175,000 of outstanding debt, and all the rest of the enterprise funds have zero debt issued. You can see water, clean water, fleet, and sanitary. This is a graph of the declining sewer utility debt. The sewer utility will be debt-free in 2020 when they pay off a balloon payment of $2,175,000. Principal payments for 2019 is $300,000. Again, for the sewer budget, I have the cash estimates and proposed. We're looking at ending the year at a little over $9,700,000. Both for 2018 and 2019, we had operating gains of $1.2 million for both years, contributing to the increase in cash. For 2019, we're recommending a $3.4 million sewer rehab to reduce I&I, offset the operating increases, causing a reduction in cash for 2019 of $1.3 million to end the year proposed at $8.4 million. Even with the cash reserves at increased levels, we're still not at enough for future replacement of sewer infrastructure. So we are submitting this budget in for a sewer rate evaluation to see what kind of adjustments we may be able to make. So I'll switch to the water utility budget. At the end, we'll approve the two resolutions. The water utility operating revenue. So this is the fifth budget we're going over, the same type of summary, 2018 budget compared to 2019 proposed. Our operating revenue is looking at going up on $296,000 or a 5.8% increase. It's mainly due to increase in volumes of $140,000 for commercial and $142,000 for public fire protection. Operating expenses, an increase of $104,000 compared to your 2018 budget. Majority of this increase is in depreciation of $95,000. Non-operating revenue is interest income on investments up $20,000. Transfers is the utility tax transfer to the general government of $900,000 and a cell phone transfer to the RecPlex for their TR program of $120,000. Utility tax is down $30,000 due to the decrease in the village's mill rate for this coming year. We have decision packets, which we'll go over in the next couple of slides. Water operating revenue, you can see the biggest customer here is our industrial customers at $1.5 million, or 30% of our budget. They're down from the previous year slightly. The next biggest component is our residential, $1.5 million, or 30% of our budget. It's up some for 2019. And then our third is public fire protection, $1.1 million, or 22%, up some in that category also. And the other categories follow our multifamily, up some, commercial also up, and then public authority about the same, $85,000 or 2% of our revenue source. None of this reflects any changes by the Public Service Commission because we have done an application. It's currently in our consultant Baker Tilly's hands to review the application. It's gone through most of the review process. It still has upper management in the firm to review it, and then it will be submitted to the Public Service Commission for their recommendations. Water operating expenses. You can see the breakdown of the expenses. Treatment is the biggest, which is $2.1 million, or 46% of our budget. This is Kenosha Water Utility. We purchase all of our water from them. And it's about the same in terms of the cost from one year to the next. Personnel is at $0.6 million, or 14% of our budget. Includes operational labor, clerical and administration allocations, depreciation, $1.2 million, or 25% of our budget, recognizing the cost of the infrastructure over its useful life. It's a non-cash expense, which we're recognizing, and the infrastructure is actually either donated or by developers or installed and paid by special assessments. Other charges of 13% includes electric of $131,000, which is similar to our 2018 budget, and contractual services, supplies, phone, et cetera, in this category. ISF, or Fleet Internal Service Fund, charges of 2% or $97,000 for the use of the vehicles and equipment from operated and maintained by the Fleet Internal Service Fund. Now, hand it over to John to talk about our decision packets and our capital requests.
Thank you, Kathy. I do have five decision packets that I'm recommending. The first one is replacing three of our hydrometers. Anytime a contractor or a resident wants to use some water out on the field, so let's say we have a or someone is filling a pool or a contractor is doing a development and they need some water for whatever that they need, we actually offer a hydrant with a backflow, but they have a meter with a backflow preventer on a hydrant, and then we rent that out to them as an option to purchase water from the village. So we have some that have exceeded their useful life. We have nine total, and we're looking to replace three of them. The next one we have is some water system planning model, $10,000. We do have a model that we run through. It hasn't been calibrated, and it's been a few years now. So we are looking to update that model, especially with a lot of the large users that we've had with Haribo and the hospital and some other potential developments coming in, just to make sure that everything we have is sized correctly. Painting the lattice water tower, we are looking to do an interior and an exterior paint on that tower. That's located around Highway C, very close to Station 2. I believe it's been over 15 years since that's been painted, so that's due to be painted. And then the other two are the 50% from the sewer utility. This is just the water component of it, converting a part-time to full-time position, and then that technical support crew lead, which is a working field position from, it just gives them a little bit extra pay to make those decisions out in the field. And that's what I have for decision packets. The capital that we have a lot of water meter proposed in here. You know, we are proposing some monies for new meters based on how much development we're going to have. We do have a replacement schedule of 20 years for the residentials from the Public Service Commission. So we track how many meters are due for that. So we're looking at some money to replace them. We have been upgrading our industrial commercial meters. The old ones were, they had a hard time capturing some of the low flow when they're accurate with high flow. So the new technology on the on these meters is very good at capturing low flow, like at a quarter gallon a minute, up to like 500, 600, 700, even over 1,000 gallons a minute. And so we do believe by capturing the low flow and the high flow more accurately, we will offset the cost for that. Traverse City hydrant replacement for the $15,000. We are looking at replacing two of those. It's just an older hydrant that we have within the village. We don't actively go out and try to replace them. They tend to just leak on their own. They don't offer parts or these hydrants anymore, so we do replace them with the more current ones. So just to be proactive, we allocate two. If none leak, we don't do it. If four end up leaking, then we're a little bit over budget. Hopefully it averages out to the two a year. The paving program water adjustments is just a component of the paving program for adjusting valves, making sure if there's anything wrong within the water system, we make those repairs when the road repaving is done. The water meter, MXU repair. The MXU is actually the transmitting device that gets the data from the meter out to the person out reading the meter. And then for paving sites, we did repaint the 93rd water booster last year. So now that that's repaved and done, contractors are out of there, we are looking at repaving the area from 93rd Street up to round, including the T-turnaround of the 93rd booster station. That's our 5 million gallon ground storage unit. And as a one-time capital that we are recommending is an installation of antenna for a remote water meter read. We have around 4,500, give or take, some meters within the village. Someone has to go out and read all those meters every month. They don't have to physically walk up to them, but make a drive and go around. And so you get the monthly data. So you know, average home maybe use 2 or 3,000 gallons, but that's really all that you know. Once you get to some of the industrial, you just know, you know, this company used 1 million gallons this month or whatever that it may be. By having the remote water meter read, you can actually get down to 1 hour reads. So you'll know how much water somebody used within an hour, which is really nice once you get to water conservation. You know, if you have a house where they're using water, like at 1 gallon a minute all night, they probably have a leaking toilet. You know, we could send them a letter, hey, you know what? We noticed you're using a little bit of water 24/7, that there may be a problem that you want to look into. We could use for some of our industrial users, you know. I mean, there's a lot of applications for it. And then we don't have to go out and actually physically read every month all the water meters. So that is the capital that I have for the water utility.
Do we have a – so with approving that capital program, we wouldn't be reading water meters, you know, by drive-by or anything?
Correct. We would not have to. I mean, if there's a problem, we would still have to go down and –
yeah.
And change an MXU if it, you know, that's the reading device. If it stopped reading, those also have a life on them of around 10 years. It's a battery operated device. But yeah, we would not have to go out and read meters anymore. That would be, and there are some communities like Madison has been doing it and some other, you know, communities in Wisconsin have been doing it. And so we wouldn't be the first one out of the chute either, which is always good.
Yeah, I think that we'd use our personnel a lot more efficiently doing something else rather than.
Absolutely, because back in the day, we'd spend about 2 weeks reading water meters and then 1 week going out and doing rereads. So you have one person pretty much full-time taking care of that. Of the 4,500 meters that we have, about 4,200 have that remote reading device on them, and we are budgeting to do the 180 of them this year. So by the time the antenna gets up, it'll be end of the year before it's up and going, but we should have everyone ready to go on that.
Water meters will, they'll, once they're switched out, every home will essentially report, right? Their water usage will be read here at your office.
Correct. Right. We will not have to switch the meters out. The meters are already in place, that the readers are already in place, but we just don't have one common antenna to collect all the signals from those transmitters. By putting, you know, a reader. It's actually on top of the Lakeview Lift Tower, which is on the 5700 block of 165. Well, actually, a line of sight will be able to capture all the meters within Pleasant Prairie.
So this will pay for itself easily within a year, where essentially one staff person is reading meters for $42,000. That will pay for itself in a year.
Yeah, well, right now we're spending about 1 week reading meters because we don't have to go door to door. The reference that I made with Trustee Polakoff was back 10, 15, 20 years ago, you actually had to go and actually put a little touchpad, it was called, and touch something on every meter. And then they had the MXUs where it was remote, where you would just have to just kind of get close to it and really just do a drive-by. And now will be a spot where you won't even have to drive. You'll have an antenna that'll bring it up to the 165 tower or the Lakeview Tower and actually transmit the data over to the Praying Center where we can do the billing from there.
It'll pay for itself in 3 years then.
Yeah, I mean, it'll pay for itself at some duration, correct.
Good idea.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Are you ready for motions? Or you?
No.
Darn,
I'm going for a couple more slides here. So first of all, again, we're ending this budget with water utility cash balances. We're estimating gaining some cash in the water utility for 2018, ending the year at $5.4 million. And then this proposed budget, even without any changes in rates, will bring in an additional $200,000 for a total of $5.6 million ending cash balance. Cash balance is important for future replacement of infrastructure. So the next slide shows your capital asset value at the end of 2016 and 17. Actually, the total asset value for 2017 is $126 million across all of our enterprise funds, which is up from $124 million in 2016, with the water and sewer having the most costly infrastructure across these five different enterprise funds. This is our cash summary. We've been talking about cash at the end of each of the budgets, and so this summarizes our cash across all the enterprise funds. Sewer had the largest increase or decrease we're proposing in cash of $1.4 million because of that I&I lining project we're doing for over $3 million. There's also a decrease in cash of $0.3 million for the clean water utility, and there's small increases in cash across all the other funds. Overall, expecting to end 2018 with $19 million in cash across all the enterprise funds, and again in 2019 pretty much maintaining with the ups and downs across all the funds for about $19 million. How does this compare to our assets in these funds? In 2017, across all the enterprise funds on this graph, cash of $13.8 million averages 11.4% of capital assets, which are valued at $122.4 million. Of the three largest enterprise funds, sewer utility has the best cash position with a replacement of 13.39% of its infrastructure cost. So we have already forwarded both the sewer and water utility to Baker Tilly, our consultant. Baker Tilly themselves will be evaluating our sewer rates. For the water utility, the Public Service Commission needs to determine and do a rates case on the water utility. So we filed with Baker Tilly. They reviewed our application, and we have a couple of higher-level management staff at Baker Tilly that had to put their final stamp on it. So I don't think it's been filed with the Public Service Commission, but it will be very shortly. So I'm looking at the Public Service Commission would determine when they'll finish their rate case, which it could be anywhere from 5 to 6 months. And then at that point, we should be done with the sewer rate review and determine how that comes out. With the water utility, the major reason we have filed with them, and in the resolution it actually gave you the time frames of when we had our last full-blown rate case and also when we did a couple of purchase water adjustments. But since then, we've had Niagara added as a customer. We've lost We Energy as our largest customer. and we are looking at Bristol being a wholesale water customer. And we need a rate for Bristol to determine what their wholesale rate is. So we have those three major things going on that we needed to file with the Public Service Commission to balance or adjust the rates. I'm sure there might be some kind of rate increase for the water utility based on how their cash balances. The sewer utility could be maybe a rate adjustment or downward, depending on, because we are gaining cash at a great rate in the sewer utility. But once we get these back and we work through these, we might adjust the budget because we don't want too big of increases. So we might adjust the budget at that point and bring back a budget amendment with the sewer rate and water rate recommendations.
Is the city considering any increases in sewer and water?
I think they're looking at a rate, water rate, in the year or two, because they applied for the lead program, and they have to do a rate study within 2 years?
Within 2 years.
2 years of that program being started. So I'm expecting the water to come forward pretty quickly. But we have done a lot of improvements in our system to help hopefully help us offset any increases they may have. We've gotten rid of our standby meters along the northern border, more toward the middle of the village. And then we also have relayed the lines so that when it comes into the village, it doesn't go through a subdivision anymore. It goes straight to our booster station. So they're no longer providing public fire protection to that subdivision that this main used to run through. So hopefully with those couple changes, when they file a rate increase, we will be there to give them our case in terms of what kind of rates they're proposing and what changes we've made. So if you guys have any questions, otherwise we have the two resolutions. Both the resolutions have historical information on when our last rate increases were and the information that we are filing with our consultant, Baker Tilly, and with the Public Service Commission.
Move approval of Resolution 1842 for the 2019 sewer utility budget as recently outlined.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Move approval of Resolution 1843.
Second.
2019 water utility budget.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion on 1843? Hearing none, those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Kathy. That brings us to item C, and they're looking to table this one, but Jane? This is to consider and accept the Suburban Mutual Aid Assistance Response Team's agreement. Chief?
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. My intent tonight was to come forward and have you review and approve a memo of understanding between the Village of Pleasant Prairie and the other agencies involved in the SMART concept. The SMART concept is, as you said, the Suburban Mutual Aid Response Team for Law Enforcement. As our due diligence in this, I had the village attorney review it. It came back with a clean bill of approval there. He recommended that we have our insurance carriers take a look at it. Our general liability insurance agent carrier took a look at it. They approved it. I'm waiting at this point for workers' comp carrier and the auto coverage carrier to review it and give their approval to before I bring it to you. I don't have that at this point. I was anticipating having that, and I don't have that right now. So I would request that this be tabled for a further future date.
Need a motion?
I move to table the proposed Suburban Mutual Assistance Response Teams agreement.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. This doesn't need a timeline for tabling.
No.
All right. Further discussion? Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So carries. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Item D is to consider and approve Resolution 1838 as accepting public improvements as it relates to the Arbor Ridge subdivision.
Mr. President, members of the board, this evening I bring before you a proposed acceptance of public improvements for the Arbor Ridge subdivision. It's generally located in the Prairie Ridge commercial area. just a little bit south of Highway 15, north of Highway C, and west of 94th. As you can see on the first slide, the roadway is in, the curb and gutter is in. They have the erosion control established with the grass and the silt fence. It actually looks really nice. They've done a really nice job. A little bit slower than what we like to see it move, but they were able to get it down and actually a verbal to start construction within those single-family lots in there. You can go to the next slide. Oh, it's already up. Look at that. And so we're looking at approving for the sanitary sewer main. And Village Crews, the Village Construction Management team, went down and inspected this from start to finish. 2,270 feet of sanitary sewer with 45 services. The storm sewer had 2,810 feet with 45 services, and the water main was 2,490 feet of water main, 45 services, with just under 2,500 feet of actual roadway completed. The developer has been compliant with everything that we've asked them to do, and I do recommend accepting these public improvements in the Arborage subdivision. There will be a warranty period, and once that warranty period is up, we will release any funds that are held for those public improvements.
I'm sorry, was this under the new road spec? Or?
Yes, it was. Okay. This does have the gravel, the concrete with the 1¾-inch overlay of asphalt.
I move that we approve the Resolution 1838, accepting the public improvements at Arbor Ridge.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So carries. Thank you, John. That brings us to item E, that is to consider and approve Resolution 1835 of the Village of Pleasant Prairie to close the dark store loopholes. Stop the shift.
We'll find out tomorrow night just how well this is going to go.
Who has this one, Nathan?
I believe that this is a league resolution that was drafted, and you know the issue well enough, so I won't belabor the evening discussing further the dark store loopholes. But again, like has already been said, we hope that our legislators will recognize the need to address this issue so that residential taxpayers and small businesses do not bear the burden.
Move to adopt Resolution 1835.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
With a prayer.
Well, I guess their motto is better late than never, but you know, this comes at the expense of the residential and small business taxpayers. So very important. And hopefully they will take heart of this resolution and get things moving. So further discussion, those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So carries. Village Board comments.
Just a comment to Jane Snell and to Kathy's group at the front counter for the last couple of weeks. Been very busy, over 3,000 early voters. That's a lot of people to contend with at the front counter. And as far as I know, it's been handled very well, and hopefully tomorrow will go smooth and we'll get through this until the next big one comes around.
3,400 to be exact. And how much larger was it since the last gubernatorial? I think 2,100, Jane, was it?
Yeah, the last one was 2,100. So it was about 1,200. More voters voting absentee.
So we thank our legislators who are also very concerned with elections and causing a little bit more stress on the frontline crews to eke out whatever vote they need.
Listen to the excuses after tomorrow night.
And the same accolades to the staff involved with the budget. There's never enough money going around, and there's creativity, and there's sacrifice and ways to find money here and there. So to everybody involved with the budget process, it's every year it amazes me that we do what we do with the budget that we have.
One other item is, if you've read the obituaries the last couple of days, Betty Weinberger passed away, and a longtime resident, her and her husband, and very active in the community, and sad to see her go. But.
With that, I move to adjourn.
A second.
Motion a second. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carries.